pretty baby, my pretty little lady. She's so pretty baby. CKUT 90.3, it's THT Entertainment back in the building. My name is Colin Hassel on the drums, and to my left, as per usual, it's Jason Alexander. Now, unfortunately, our time for today has come close to its conclusion, but we're going to be back. When are we coming back?
Yes, sir, we're going to be back, same time, same place, next week, every week for the month of December. The Montreal session is in full effect with THT Entertainment. Hit us up on IG at THT Entertainment and join us in sharing your voice to the world. We'll see y'all guys next week. We appreciate y'all. We love y'all. We out.
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is December 3rd. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I'll be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyekehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back with Off the Hour.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
First, news. This week, the federal government has changed their travel restrictions due to a new COVID variant, Omicron. As of December 1st, all travelers who arrive in Canada by air from other countries than the U.S. will have to be tested and quarantined until the results are in, regardless of their vaccination status. Unvaccinated travelers will still have to quarantine for 14 days. As of November 30th, 2021, travelers need to be fully vaccinated to travel within Canada, with very few exceptions, says federal officials. The campaign to vaccinate children 5 to 11 began 9 days ago and continued into this week. And solidarity gatherings were held en masse this week across the country, including in Montreal and Kahnawake. Demonstrators and land defenders acted in support of the ongoing Wet'suwet'en resistance to the Coastal GasLink pipeline development project on their unceded territory. About 20 cars blocked the highway along the Mercier Bridge for roughly half an hour between 12 and 1 p.m. on Wednesday, and a group of almost 100 people blocked a railway track near the Rosemont neighborhood on the island of Montreal on Sunday night. Police are still present on the Wet'suwet'en territory. And over 10,000 daycare workers are on strike in Quebec as of this week. 11,000 workers have shut down 400 public daycares across the province for an indefinite amount of time. The educators who work on the centers say they've reached an agreement in salary negotiations with the province, but the same salary benefits were not given to the support staff like maintenance crews and kitchen workers. Strikers are part of the CSN union. This is CKUT 90.3 FM.
Polo and Pan, Cyclorama Tour. Polo and Pan. December 11th, Place Belle. One night only in Montreal. Take me back. Get tickets now at evenco.ca. Polo and Pan, Cyclorama Tour.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. We're sharing the air this season with creators that you might like to hear from, and we'll continue to do that today. We're turning into It's Going Down Radio to hear from Adrienne Mary Brown, an author, scholar, and artist. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some news that you can use.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia.
Hi there. Today we're excited to share a conversation with Adrienne Marie Brown, the writer of such books as Holding Change, We Will Not Cancel Us, Pleasure Activism, and Emergent Strategy. Adrienne's recent novella, Grievers, the first of a trilogy, was published in AK Press's new Black Dawn imprint of speculative fiction. In this discussion, we dig into the book, which is set in Detroit with a new illness that seems to only affect black people. Spoiler alert. We talk also about the role of speculative fiction in liberation movements, spirituality, ritual, and grief in our organizing, and holding space for intergenerational struggle. If you like this conversation, you can find the transcript and printable zine on our website in a week at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. Support us by sharing our content in real life and through social media. Send us money or buy merch to help us pay for the transcriptions. And you can put us on your local radio via the radio link on our website.
Well, I'm Adrienne Marie Brown. I'm a writer. I write speculative fiction, science fiction, and nonfiction that is about... maybe it's called transformative fiction, you know, transformative nonfiction, you know, like I'm really thinking about how we transform our conditions and transform ourselves to transform the world around us. And I recently moved this year from Detroit to Durham, although I still feel my roots in Detroit, and I'm shooting new roots down into the ground here in Durham. And I'm an auntie and a Virgo and a voracious feeler.
That's really exciting to hear. You're in the same state as where we're based in this podcast. I'm over here in outside of Asheville right now. So welcome.
Beautiful. I keep hearing I need to go there.
Yeah,
so
it's, you know, it's a place. There's a lot of good people there.
It's a place.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I love that idea of transformative fiction, and I'm also thinking about, like, speculative fiction. I first came to your work through Octavius Brood, which is a collection of science...
Yeah, visionary fiction.
And, like, it was so exciting to see fiction by people who are, like, grounded in movement work, and I use the stories when I'm teaching around, like, liberatory science fiction. And, like, I feel like from that time, you and your co-editors and contributors are making the case that science fiction and liberation work go together to envisioning a new world. And then you also kind of develop that in your nonfiction by kind of like theorizing through Octavia Butler, who's a very wonderful science fiction writer. writer. So I just want to start kind of like generally, because I know people, especially people who are like committed to changing the world, will sometimes dismiss fiction as like not important or escapist.
Yeah.
I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about like what you think stories can do, and especially stories outside of like strict realism and how they like help us.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of people throughout history who have been trying to organize and change the world have realized that ultimately what we're trying to do is change the entire narrative inside of which we live, and that the narratives inside of which we live are what allow us to either accept the oppression, accept the oppressive conditions we're in and participate and become cogs in them, or to see ourselves in resistance to those systems, or to see ourselves as transforming and creating something beyond those systems. And, you know, Gloria Ansel Dua said that it's like we have to dream it before we can create it. I'm paraphrasing. And I also think the work of Tony Cade Bambara and the thinking of, you know, our work as artists is to make the revolution irresistible. Mm-hmm. That always comes into play for me here, because anyone who's organized for any period of time, we learn very quickly that if we don't have a story that people can see themselves a part of, it doesn't matter how good our data and our facts are, right? People are not going to radically change their climate behaviors, climate impacting behaviors, because we're all going to die because of what's happening to the climate. We need a story in which we fall back into right relationship with this planet and what that can look like. So I think every advance that we have made for human rights, social justice rights, economic and environmental rights, there's a story in there about how humans are changing that helps us to make that advance. And so then the work of writers becomes really important, that it's actually on us in some ways to figure out what are new stories that feel compelling for people to move towards a future that involves changing themselves. And that's one of the things I think Octavia Butler did really, really well. I think she's like the master class of that, because she did not write easy futures. She did not write utopias. But she did write worlds where we could imagine ourselves still wanting to persist and wanting to figure it out and wanting to form the kind of relationships that could persist through change. And that's, I hope that's the lineage that I'm picking up, and that there's a whole, you know, generation of writers who grew up reading Octavia, are shaped and inspired by her and by so many other Black speculative fiction writers and Ursula Le Guin, you know, feminist science fiction writers and other folks. So, you know, I hope that field grows and grows. I want to see lots of people who are up to movement work also writing the stories of our future.
Yeah, I love how you're talking about that, and it made me think about people sometimes talking about how like we need on the left or whatever, like some kind of myth that is like compelling, but there's like often a feeling of danger with myth, because we've seen myth be motivated obviously for like horrific violence and fascism.
Yes.
And I'm wondering just like also like if you have thoughts about like myth making in this and also because like myth is like a spiritualized story in a way, like has kind of ritual and practice that's often part of it. And I'm wondering if you think like spirituality is connected in this kind of like fuller vision of the world that like our movements need to kind of engage with.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I feel like I've come back around to it. I feel like this past 2 years has really been kind of a shock to my system as an organizer and someone who has, you know, just deeply loved and cared about humans, and watching what this last 2 years has looked like and how far we are from a future in which we could think collectively and make decisions for the community and not just for ourselves. So I have been driven back to the spiritual realm more in this period, in the sense of, I don't think it's enough to have a great case and a great set of information and a great even set of practices or a roadmap. I think that we have to attend to the aspect of humanity that thinks of ourselves as having some kind of destiny, some kind of purpose, some kind of calling for being here, right? And I think if we don't, we cede that territory to the purpose of capitalism, the manifest destiny, right? The destiny of colonial efforts, which is we constantly grow and we accumulate more and more territory and material and then we die. And, you know, you're just trying to win the game for while you're alive, and then you're gone. And it doesn't matter what you leave behind. And if we have a radically different purpose, which I think we do, I think our purpose is around loving each other. And I think our purpose is around finding ways to be in relationship that transcend difference, you know, that actually create a biodiversity out of a bunch of different peoples. And so I'm like, if that's our purpose, which does feel spiritual to me, that work feels spiritual to me in the sense that it is greater than the material, right? Like it's something that happens that we can feel in the body, but we can also feel, I feel deeply connected to ancestors who I knew while they were living, and now they are not in a body anymore. They still shape my decision-making. They still tell me things that I need to do and pay attention to. I feel very connected to those who are not born yet, generations that are yet to come, who have intentions and designs for what this world could look like. And I feel deeply connected and driven by the non-human elements of this world. I feel that the water has a design, and the air has a design, and the creatures all have their purposes. And I think we're the lost ones, right? Yeah. I think the humans have lost our way inside of the greater narrative. And I think in the myth piece, the thing that comes to mind, I was recently taught this wisdom that an Ojibwe elder who has since become an ancestor, Walter Brissett, shared, which is that the most European thing is to think that there's one way to do everything, mm-hmm. or anything. And when I think about that colonial impulse, then I'm like, the opposite of that is to have many, many myths and to sort of live in a world in which all of them can coexist and dance with each other. I like that. You know, I've read some really beautiful collections of stories, of origin stories and myths that people hold for the beginning of the world. And I'm like, they're all really perfectly logical for their location and their time. And I'm like, I think we need to create myths that feel perfectly logical for our location and our time.
Yeah. I guess I kind of want to pick up on this thread, but grounding it more in Grievers, your recently published novel, which I was like, I really loved.
Thank you.
And because I think, I mean, and I guess in this discussion, I'm going to talk about what happens in the novel. So I guess I'll have to put some spoiler alerts.
Spoiler alert. But,
so the, yeah. The main character who we follow closely throughout, like she, Dune, is grappling with some of this stuff, I think very specifically, especially as it comes to like grief and loss. Before I go more specific to that, like there is a reflection that she has on this idea of like cultural appropriation in the kind of rituals that we do, and like wondering what her place is in that, and like thinking also about the formation of Black culture and the history of cultural theft, and like kind of how she's trying to like piece things together or sees the her elders doing that, and like what's okay for her to do. And I thought that discussion in the book was just really perceptive, like and flexible in thinking about how we at like culture. What we do, and like and I just wonder if you want to talk a little bit about that and the kind of like the formation of culture in our present actions in relation to like the histories that we inherit.
Well, I think if you're okay with it, I want to read that paragraph that you're referencing. So in the book, Dune is a very analytical character, is someone who doesn't think of herself as spiritual at all. And she's been raised by a mother who is very spiritual and a father who is highly analytical, both of whom have now passed. And so she's creating this, what she thinks is a research project in her basement about all the death that's happening in Detroit. And her aunt comes over and she's like, it's an altar. It's a sacred space, actually, that you're creating. So Dune is hesitant about that because she said, we never had a clear lineage and I don't want to be, you know, and she talks about that kind of grabbing everything all around me. She says, I don't belong to anything. It doesn't belong to me. And what Eloise, her aunt, says to her is, when everything has been taken, filling that emptiness ain't appropriation. It's something else. It ain't pure, none of it. I think of these practices, my orisha, my altars, my prayers and chants, and all this accumulation of spiritual armor as something to comfort me when my ancestral ghost limbs hurt. Because I need spirit so much, I answer what calls me. Spirit is bigger than any one lineage. It comes through all these channels. It's complicated, beautifully complicated, but it ain't appropriation, not amongst displaced and denied peoples. It's different. At minimum, it's sacred data. So, you know, when that piece of writing was coming through, I was very uncomfortable. It felt like it was something that was coming from beyond or coming from another place that I needed to contend with and sit with. And it felt like something that also felt true as it came through. And I feel like I have sat in rooms full of displaced peoples, peoples who through the process of colonization have been intentionally pulled away from their indigenous stories and their indigenous landscapes and their indigenous songs and wisdom, whatever that originally was. And not only displaced, but then the multiracial and interracial pieces start to come in. Dune is an interracial character, and most of us in the U.S. at this point are inter-ethnic, if not interracial people, no matter how we are viewed, right? There has been some, you know, straying from whatever that indigenous singular identity was. So I've been in so many spaces where people are being called by spirit into an action and then are catching themselves and stopping themselves and in a way policing themselves. Like, is this right? Is this okay? And I think that it's such a complicated piece of ground. In my own life have felt myself really drawn to spaces that had an intention to be shared. So I've been really drawn to the wisdom of Aikido. I've been really drawn to the wisdom of Buddhism. I've been really drawn into some of the wisdom and practices of yoga, things where there was an intention. There were teachers who were like, we want this to go as far as it can. We think there's something universal here that everyone can use. And I've always defaulted to the idea of if someone in the room has this practice that they can authentically bring in, that's good news. But I do think we all need practices. And so I think that there's a big question for me right now for everyone to be figuring out, how do I find the spiritual practices that help me line up with spirit, help me actually hear spirit? And how do I do that in a way that is what I think of as right relationship, right? Where I'm not dishonoring, stealing, or taking. And I just love this wisdom from Eloise that it's like, if everything's been taken from you, then accumulating some practices is not a bad thing. It's actually okay. And I think a lot of us need some permission to find those ways. And then, you know, then inside of that, to figure out, how do I do this without causing harm? What does that look like? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I really resonate with that. As a person who's brought up Jewish and like pretty observant, and then rebelled against it because it felt like it didn't align with the way that I wanted to live in the world, and then like recently finding community with like other trans and queer anarchist Jews, I was like, oh, we can do this in a way that works for me and like keeps some of the like rituals that I grew up with, or rethinks them really. But like, I don't have to just exactly. Like, I mean, it's such a big part of me. I like don't have to like get rid of it or like.
Yeah. And it's even like a thing of releasing the shame that comes from not having those things or from having them tied to a politic that you don't agree with. You know, like I grew up in a Christian household and going to Christian church services. And I still love more than almost anything to be in a group of people singing together, mm-hmm. singing spiritual music, singing hymns, singing in harmony with each other. It moves me. I love praying with other people. I love laying hands on people when it's time to heal. All of those practices still generate in me a connection to spirit, even if I needed to move them outside of a political context that was homophobic and transphobic and racist and, you know, hierarchical and all those things that don't align with my politic. And so I think there is something about reclaiming the practices that are around you and that you grow up with. And then I think there's also, you know, for me and my lineage, recognizing like some place it got cut off that I need to be in a worshipful relationship with the moon. But I know that I need to be in a worshipful relationship with the moon because the moon tells me that directly. And so then I can, you know, and I can go research and try to figure out like, what are the practices for this? And what I've cobbled together is something between what I've researched and learned and what I can feel called directly to. And I think that feels really important to me, that like, as a human being on land in relationship to the earth, in relationship to other people, there's some of this that we have to be able to feel. Mm-hmm. And we have to be able to trust that that feeling can cut through the divisiveness that colonialism implanted in our society.
Yeah. And I think the spiritual or the ancestral phantom limbs is a really perfect way of saying that. And I think it's an experience that people have who like might not even identify in those ways of like having lost something or knowing that they lose something. So yeah, I think
on a deepest level, I think that so much of our fighting with each other, so much of our power tripping with each other is because we have lost that place in us that needs to be in relationship to something much larger than ourselves. Like there's a part of us that needs that. And if you're like, but it doesn't make sense to me, there'd be one white guy on a throne.
Yeah.
You know, if that story doesn't zhuzh out for you, then, you know, it's like, oh, and what I feel like I've been learning slowly is that almost every peoples has some part of our story that is about being tied into the land, being tied into the actual superstructure of nature, of the natural world, and that we are not outside of that, but part of it. That for me has been the way that I'm like, it doesn't matter what other things are going on in your belief system. If you can go out and get in relationship with the land you're on, you'll be heading in the right direction. And it needs to be a real authentic listening relationship, right? Because the land has borders and boundaries of her own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I want to get a little bit to like place, but sticking with ritual, thinking about grief, one of the, you know, really moving parts early in the book is the extended scene of Dune doing the work of kind of like burying or not burying, I guess, like just dealing with her mother's body, cremating her. I mean, so I've been thinking about this via other texts, like how grieving itself can be like a political act and like certain rituals can be forms of resistance. And I'm just wondering how you think, what kind of act is Dune undertaking in that moment? Is it just for her?
Yeah.
Or does it belong to the movement, like in honoring her mother and her father's, like, because they're both people who had been part of movements, right?
Yeah. You know, so I think that this is a ritual. I have done a lot of reading around death rituals, and it's so fascinating to me how recent it is that there is this economy around death that takes the bodies away from their families, away from their home as soon as possible, and that fills them with chemicals and puts them on brief display and then puts them inside of a box that's going to make decomposition very difficult, and then puts them in the ground somewhere. That's a very recent practice inside of the long history of humans, and a much more common practice in most places has been some variation of washing the body, mm-hmm. some variation of sitting and honoring the body, being with the body, everyone getting to come and say goodbye, and then a process of burying the body into the dirt or burning the body, setting up a pyre, pushing it into the water. But there were so many ways. It was like, return to nature. You came from the dust, and to the dust you shall return, right? So in this story, it's an economic resistance that, you know, Dune is like, this system did not care about my mom, did not protect her, did not keep her alive, and they don't get to touch her now.
Yeah.
So there's a part of that that's just like the resistance that poor people get to have of like, I'm not going to keep giving my body over to systems that do not care about me. I'm not going to give the bodies of the people I care about to these systems, you know? Yeah, fuck you. Right. I'm going to take her into the backyard and do this myself. And then I think there's the labor of it. It's very much a Dune setting off on an individualistic path. And, you know, I hope that readers see throughout the whole time that there's all these places where it's like, Dune probably needs more people around her right now, but she keeps turning in towards herself. And what happens when you keep turning in towards yourself, you know? And this is that first big move where it's like, what would that ceremony have looked like if she had invited her community members into it with her? You know, what would have happened if she had let movement hold her in that moment? And she's not ready to do that yet. But it's also why it's the first novella in a trilogy, because this is a long arc. I think it's a long arc to move from that individualist path to something more collective.
That was actually something I wanted to ask you about, because I think that's a huge dynamic in the book, this like going like between isolation and community, and like, and like the conflicting desires that one can have around that. And like, so Dune for much of the book is isolated in her grief, but I think in addition to the family members that she's mourning, she's grieving that community that she doesn't feel like she can take a part in, or is like some, there's some obstacle for her, even though she was like kind of born into it in a way, because her parents and her grandparents were like part of this community work.
Yeah.
So I wonder, like, I mean, this I think also connects to the illness and the theories behind the illness in the book around like grievers. Like, how, what do you think the relationship is between grief and like an attempt to recover this like intergenerational sense of struggle? Is there like a need to do it? Personal work to be able to get to the community, does it prepare us for community?
Well, one thing I wanted to interrogate was, I know a lot of people in movement who have kids, and I know a lot of people who are like, oh, because my parents were movement people, I wanted to do something different. And a lot of people, even if they end up coming back into movement, there's a part of them that's like, I need to go somewhere else, which is that there's some natural rebellion, that natural like differentiation from your parents, right? So part of it was I wanted to write that. That's like, you can be steeped in it, and then your rebellion is to go the other way. And so in some ways, Dune's rebellion is to be this introverted, kind of isolated character who comes from hyper extroverted, deeply interconnected people.
Right.
And that she's never quite felt that connection to, you know, that space to get to be her authentic self, which was also a place, you know, there's a critique of movement inside of that, that movement can have a very prescriptive way that you have to be in order to be accepted in it. And if you don't fit in, you know, I see people doing this contortion all the time to try to be like, how do I fit in and belong here? And I want movement to be the kind of space that sees itself, all the movements, you know, that are concurrent, to be spaces that see themselves as sanctuaries for people to come and be however we are moving towards justice. And instead, I think it can become this like narrow path. Like, if you're like this, you're going to get to justice. It just becomes heaven.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if you just do all these little rules, you're going to get to the utopian end game. And otherwise, you know, you're canceled, yeah. You know, or something else is going to happen to you. Right. So I wanted to give permission to Dune to go about this in her own way. And then I wanted to be in an exploration of like, how do you authentically awaken the desire in someone for community? And then how do you authentically meet that desire with community that can actually nourish what the spirit needs?
And I guess going like, in a way, that moment with Eloise is sort of like a crossroads for that. But the conflict, like one of the main conflicts of the book, is that everyone that is surrounding is getting stricken by this illness.
Yes.
And thinking like about that still on the, I guess on the idea of grief, like one of the theories that is in the book, cause there's not an explanation necessarily of what's happening, but it's only afflicting Black people in Detroit.
Yes.
And one of the theories is like that the illness is some kind of accumulation of grief, like mourning the movements. And I was thinking about our last conversation where you were talking about, you know, we haven't fully grieved the effects of COINTELPRO on the Black freedom movements.
Exactly.
So I guess like, what are you trying to capture about Black grief in this book, and the contradictions that,
yes,
that, because Dune experiences contradictions also being like interracial. What do you hope to convey about the experience of intergenerational Black movement work through that affect of grief as like the main one?
Yes. That's a great question, Scott. I mean, for me, I think there was something I am interrogating around Blackness in general, which is there's this expectation that we will persist and keep trying and keep living and keep creating culture and joy and magic without an acknowledgement of how much oppression, how much trauma, how much torture, how much death, how much accumulated conditions are still impacting us, right? So there's never a moment of, wow, that was horrific what happened to y'all, and like reparations, you know,
right.
Wow, this should not happen, like abolition, you know, like there's never, it's never a clear, just like, no people should have to live through this level of police killings. You know, seeing the data, we recognize we need to change our ways.
Right.
It never happens like that. So what happens is we're constantly in pandemic conditions, you know, combined pandemic conditions, depending on where you sit inside of blackness, plus your economic status, plus your educational status, plus these other things. So, you know, when I was living in Detroit, when I started writing this back in 2011, and what I was seeing was the city had come through, you know, was just towards the end of this massive economic crisis. You know, we were heading into the emergency manager period, and there was just this idea of like, how much can you try to humiliate a black city and act like black people don't know how to govern or how to manage our own budget and finances and our water, and, you know, just the insult of how people respond to black leadership and the inability to give any space for learning, right? It's like, we're supposed to go from having no access to power to sitting in those positions of power and doing it perfectly without that space in between to necessarily get to practice. What does it look like to govern in different ways? So there's a grief, there's shame, there's rage, and all of that is accumulating in the black body, and it shows up as early death. And what I was noticing around me was, I was like, the black people in my life don't live as long, and the deaths tend to be so unnecessary and so tragic and so often born of exhaustion, right? That it's like things that might happen to other bodies, but we don't have the spiritual immune system to respond to it because of how much we're carrying. So I wanted to write about that. And in particular Detroit, I've had a lot of people say they see their city in this book as well. You know, folks are like, there's a lot of black cities in this because there are so many similarities of what it means to be a black city in this period of history. But I wanted to spend some time there, and I wanted to feel my way into it and feel into like, what does it look like to pay a debt of grief?
Yeah.
Is it possible? Is it possible? And in this book, at least the initial answer is like, even trying to begin to turn towards it, it overwhelms. It's that much. And I think that a lot of us feel that way, that it's like, if I actually stopped to let myself feel everything that me and my people are going through on a daily basis, I would not be able to go on. Like, there's that feeling is always right there on, you know, like just there. And it's like, you got to just push forward, because if you look back, it's you're going to get sucked into that. So I also wanted to say to name that and see if we can still find something compelling to help us move forward.
The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero network of anarchist podcasts. And here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
Silver Threads, Still Walking, Still Waking is co-hosted by me, Carla Bergman.
And me, Eleanor Goldfield. This is where we interview long-term organizers and radicals about their watershed moments, what they've learned along the way, and how they maintain their hope on this path, dreaming and building emergent worlds for a present and future anchored in justice and freedom for all.
Because there are forks in the road, but they all lead us home to the fight, to the build.
Hi, you are listening to The Final Straw Radio. This is my conversation with Adrienne Marie Brown, author of Grievers, a speculative fiction novella just published by AK Press.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I'm hearing you on that idea of like, if you stopped and let it catch up with you. I mean, in a way, like, I feel like that kind of, that's still an internalization of that kind of like need to be productive and a kind of individualized feeling that doesn't actually reflect on the way that, like, you know, this kind of pain and death happen to individual bodies, but it's the effect of like a larger social war that's going on and that's creating the conditions that in which people perish.
I mean, this is part of it too, is I know you can't compare pains. I deeply believe that. I have met so many people. I know people from every kind of possible background. And what I know is that the human experience is mostly aligned and similar. Like, mostly we are struggling to belong. We want to feel safe. We want to feel dignified. We get hurt. We're trying to recover, like, for everybody of any background. And so then inside these constructs that get set up, it's like how it, the whole idea of these constructs is to divide us from having these common human experiences so that some of us can be manipulated, can be oppressed, can be overused, right? So that we can produce what others need. And there's, for me, that the tenderness, when you recognize that, that it's like, just by being born as a Black person, there is nothing about me that is necessarily distinct from the human experience. Every human is miraculous and has the capacity for all the same magics. It's all there. But because of this construct that someone came up with, which again, story, the power of story, someone came up with a story of superiority. And because of this story, an unimaginable and too heavy amount of trauma has been allowed and enacted upon my lineage.
Yeah.
And then, you know, right now is this interesting moment where Black people are looking at each other like, okay, our lives matter. We're going to raise the bar. We're going to hold this standard. And it becomes necessary then to interrogate, well, what is Blackness inside of this? Black matters, right? If our lives matter, do we mean everybody Black, monolithic Blackness? And we started to really have to name, like, we mean Black trans people. We mean Black disabled people. We mean Black queer people. We mean Black homeless people. We need Black people with HIV and AIDS. Like, we mean Black incarcerated people. Like, we're really talking about all the people who have experienced the brunt of this weight, right? Those intersectional Blacknesses that were like, those are the lives that we want to center and uplift inside of this mattering. And that's where we see that human. So even those kind of conversations, right? There are people who are like, well, I'm not even there yet.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a really interesting moment, I think, inside of Blackness, where it's like, you know, one of the things Octavia Butler, I think, always did brilliantly was say, a Black story is a human story. If I'm telling you a Black story, you, no matter who you are, can, you should be able to relate to it because it is also a human story. And I think we're in that moment on a grand scale, is like the story of what's happening with Black people, not just in the US, but globally, the story of what's happening with Black people is the human story right now. And it's not the only human story. The story of what's happening with immigrants is the human story right now. The story of what's happening with incarcerated peoples is the human story right now. And what we have to constantly be able to do is recognize our humanity is never, ever actually separate from those that we are trained to see as lesser than us. That's where, right, that's where the path has gone astray, and that's where we have to figure out, how do we return ourselves to ourselves?
Yeah, that quotation from Octavia Butler, it like also makes me think about what I love so much about her work is how complex the worlds and like the, just like the situations and conflicts and the emotions, like nothing's straightforward. It's always kind of ambiguous or ambivalent in ways. And that made me think also about like James Baldwin and everybody's protest novel, right? Like, he's like, the novel isn't here just to like send a message of Black politics. It's to like render the complexities of experience. And so in your book, like there's this like tension between like, is this like a Black illness, which like in a way kind of I think like makes Blackness this like simple thing, but like what the illness is that kind of accumulation of grief through the stories and the history, that, and that goes back to the way that you're kind of parsing Black Lives Matter to not be the monolithic, like, we know what we mean when we say Black. But like, yeah, that is this kind of, it's this weight of it, and it's this history, and it's all of these intersections.
Exactly. I mean, it feels important to me to note that, like, I know a ton of Black people who've never been stopped by the police. I know a ton of Black people who've never been arrested. I know a ton of Black people who mostly have not even felt that personally endangered by the police. But when they start to pay attention to those numbers, then they have to interrogate, okay, where in my own Black experience am I tied to that and disconnected from that? And what made that the case? Oh, it's because, you know, I have a friend who's like, I went to an all-white high school, and I went, you know, I from there kind of moved on to a path where I was mostly socialized inside of white spaces. And so I experienced microaggressive racism, but I never experienced that overt institutional racism until it was later systematic, right?
Yeah.
And so I was like, it opens up the idea that there's so much complexity happening within the Black experience right now, today. And that's why Black people run the entire gamut of politics, right? That you have your Black anarchists and you have your Black Republicans. And it's like everyone's having these human experiences and trying to figure out, how do I relate to these constructs? And I think it's a really hard thing to want to be free of a construct, and for some people to think, if I deny the construct is there, I'll be free from it.
Yeah.
And for other people to say, we have to actually point at the construct, all of us together, and tear it down for it to not be there. And yet others to be like, that construct is permanent.
Right.
You know, like all of that is happening concurrently. And so those, I get really curious all the time about that, because I'm like, I can see that ignorance is bliss. You know, I can see there are definitely some Black people who are just like bopping along, like, it's fine, it doesn't happen to me, you know, whatever. And I'm like, maybe it feels good inside of that. For me, when I'm denying something that is true, when I'm denying pain that is actually happening to myself or others, it actually causes me more suffering, you know, because it's not just the pain, but the effort to hold it down, or the effort to keep it locked behind a door. Like, eventually that effort becomes exhausting. And, you know, so for me, I'm like, let's bring it into the light and see if we can be deconstructionist.
Yeah. What you just said called to mind, and Joy James kind of tries to distinguish between threads of Black feminism, and being like, you know, there's liberal Black feminism, there's even like conservative, and then there's radical revolutionary. And she says, like, Black women in the position that they're like placed in our society in the US are seen as like default radical, even just like speaking up against racism, which doesn't need to have a radical perspective to be like, that's wrong. That's placed into right. This, like, oh my God, that's like a outrageous thing to say.
Yeah.
But so I was just thinking about how there's all these different like ways to relate to this. And I guess to make this into a question, like what the other thing I was thinking about is, so like, how do we think about, Because you're writing this within the history of Black movements and other kind of community movements and liberatory movements. Like, I feel like one interpretation could be that these people who succumb to this illness are failures in some way. But I don't think that's the story you're telling in the book. They're not, right? But it's also not like, there's not like a revolutionary response, at least in this volume of the trilogy. There's something else happening.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Well, and that it felt important to me. I will say this, like, I hope that it, as people keep reading the trilogy, I hope that it shows up in, as a form of discipline. But I was really trying to be like realistic. And what I have experienced every time there's been a massive crisis is that, even if people want to move straight to organizing, the part of us that needs to feel happens first. And even just this past couple of years going through COVID processes, you know, it was like, there was that first initial, like, you know, wave of like, people are actually grieving. People are losing folks. We're really confused. We don't actually know what to do. Let's just follow the CDC, even though we're all, you know, anti-capitalist, you know, socialist, anarchist people or whatever. We're like, sure, now we'll follow what they say, you know, and feeling myself caught. I mean, like, I wanted to be really humble in some of this, because I was like, I totally got caught up in the like corrective policing behavior of the beginning of this pandemic. I deeply did. And I still feel the vestiges of that. Like, I'm like really trying to tease out in myself, like, what is policing and what is protection inside of me? You know, when I am walking out and I see someone without their mask on, and like the part of me that wants to be like, you need to put your mask on. And then quickly this other voice, like, you don't know what that person's situation is. And like, you can't make assumptions, like, you know, and being like, you know, my responsibility is to keep my 6 feet of distance and wear my mask. Like, I am not, you know, what is the collective move that's needed right now? Like, I'm like, all that still happens. And I've been a radical organizer for 25 years. So I wanted to be in that where I was like, we don't always know what to do, especially when it's happening, when it's overwhelming. And then there are organizers. And I, you know, what we see Eloise doing in this book is really holding the position of the organizer. And I wanted people to see that even though Dune is on this individual path of her grief, organizing is still happening. People are being like, we need to figure out the response here. And one of the things that I love about Eloise is she's like, we have to resist, but I don't even know what way we need to resist yet. And I think that happens to us a lot, where we're like, we know this isn't right, but we haven't quite figured out which way we need to go.
Yeah.
And we get caught in the tension. And, you know, where my emergent strategy brain comes into this is, I think we need to be more open to the idea that we're going to run multiple experiments concurrently.
Yeah.
And so in a way, to me, the book is that, you know, it's like there's multiple things concurrently happening and we get to see Dune's experience up close, but there's also other experiments going on.
Right. Yeah. And interesting to relate it also to like COVID. Cause like, yeah, initially when COVID happened and then I was like, oh my God, these contradictions that of like what we're supposed to do and not supposed to do are going to hit everyone. And we'll like all rise up and like do a general rent strike. And like, and then like that didn't happen.
Oh, for sure.
But then the George Floyd uprising.
I thought we were going to be so clear. Yeah. I was like, we're definitely like eviction moratoriums and rent strike and like the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it was like, we're not, but Minnesota turned the fuck
right.
And they were like, oh, well, we're just going to take to the streets and y'all going to catch up.
Yeah. And I think that like that's related. Like, I think the condition, also the fact that like what's happened in Minneapolis wasn't isolated to Minneapolis, but like spread across the country, across the globe was in relation to the pandemic and the work that people were doing that isn't as visible as like a riot, but like the kind of mutual aid care work that people were doing in the immediate like effects of COVID and having to figure out how to survive when you're abandoned.
Right. And also the analytical work that people are doing all the time. You know, I think that when something happens, you know, like when something like COVID happens, if we don't have an analysis, then it can feel like an isolated event, or we can be like, we don't know why this is spreading the way it's spreading and hitting certain communities the way it is. We don't understand, you know, why these variants are emerging or anything. And I think it's when you're steeped in organizing, then you're like, well, I do have a sense of why. Yeah. And actually, it is deeply tied back to what's happening to George Floyd.
Yeah.
This, you know, so being able to make that connection of like, if you don't care about the life of poor people, and you don't care about the life of Black people, and you don't care about the life of Indigenous people and immigrant people, if you don't care about the life of people who have disabilities or people who are struggling with the system, struggling with substances, if you dehumanize those people, then when something like COVID happens, that same pathway of thinking, you know, is just going to burn it all down. And now, you know, we're in such an interesting place. And I think grievers and the real world are very aligned in that way, that we've lost a huge portion of people. And there's this, how do I still be normal? You know, this, now do we function? Now do we go back to normal?
Right.
And, you know, it's a little bit more pronounced, I think, in grievers, you know, that normal is not available in the way that we currently seem to think it is. But in terms of the actual impacts, it's just as unavailable to us now, right?
Yeah.
Like what's happening right now is just like people who try to go about things as normal die.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then you sort of move back into a boundary and then repeat the cycle, right? And because we don't have any strong enough leadership to be like, actually, we're going to change the rules so that we can actually survive this a different way, we don't have that kind of leadership.
I mean, yeah, it's like the negative side of running multiple experiments. Like where I live, the school board just decided to lift the mask mandate in the elementary schools. But like,
I
know, and I got a kid in there, and like, but the people in the school are like preparing for a spike, obviously, because I'm like, this is unsafe, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's like, everyone has a hand in this and no one's actually on the same page. It's just, yeah.
Well, and I think this is the interesting thing, right? Is part of, you know, from a scientific perspective, like you run the experiments so that you can reach some conclusion. You gather the data and then you apply that data.
Yeah. Right?
And what I think has happened is like, we can see the multiple experience happening around the globe. So, you know, my friend Sonia Renee Taylor is down in New Zealand. And so I've been watching how New Zealand is navigating this experiment versus how the US is. In New Zealand, they're like, we got a case, quarantine everything.
Yeah.
And We're going to track what unfolds down to the, you know, they're like, we found out exactly the moment that these two doors were open in a hospital and the Delta variant was able to move between the rooms. And like, that's how this person got infected. Right. I mean, that's something unimaginable
here, right.
That we would be tracking and be self-responsive and be able to say we're shutting everything down for 3 weeks until we have contained this and so on and so forth. So even in at that level, we do have the multiple experiments happening, but we're not, we as the U.S. is very locked in, like we're not going to learn from anyone else's experiment.
Right.
And we will not let new data change our position, which is a very, I think, a very American way, right? It's like, there's really a commitment to like, I'm going to put what I believe over any new incoming information. And the, you know, because superiority makes you think that that can create a different kind of reality. And I mean, I don't know if you've been following, but I can't look away from these stories of people who were hardcore COVID deniers and hardcore anti-vaxxers who are dying now.
Yeah.
And I just keep reading these stories and feeling in myself the complexity of emotions that get generated in that, right? Because I'm like, you are loved by people. There's people who care about you. And in some cases, it's like the people are like, we were fighting with them till the very end and they just refused to get help. They refused. And I find myself really mystified. Like, I really want to understand. And you know, as a, someone who's in this novel writing journey, you know, I'm like, I really want to understand what it is in our human nature that allows us to create and maintain conditions of illogical danger.
You know, that actually just, I hadn't thought about this before, but so one of a novel I really love is Ishmael Reed's Mumbo Jumbo, which is also about a pandemic that is like about black cultural crossover into white culture. And when the way that Ishmael Reed talks about Western culture as a whole there is it's a death cult. It's a death cult, like with a propulsion to kill everyone in the end, even the white people who are like helming it, right?
Yeah, I mean, there is something, you know, I've written about this in a number of ways, but I think that there is something, again, if you feel truly disconnected from spirit, like if you are like, I'm not connected to something that's larger than myself, I can't feel it, right? Because I'm like, I feel my connectedness to aliveness so viscerally that nothing can take it from me. I'm like, I don't have to, there's no argument to it. It's like, it's so clear in me. And it's taken a lot of work to uncover that and get into it and like trust it, but it's there. And I think there's a lot of people who don't feel that. And in the not feeling of that, I think the terror is so absolute that it's like you have to almost disconnect from being from any desire to continue living.
Yeah.
And I think that death cult piece, I think there is a grand scale collective suicidality that is at play and has been. And I don't think it's always been that way, which is always important for me to remember. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is not our human nature, because there were many, 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 many experiments in humans that have not moved towards death or towards war, towards violence, towards guns, towards domination. There's all these other experiments, but how do those experiments actually survive the onslaught of those who are really obsessed with moving towards death and moving, you know, because in some ways it's like if you're trying to move towards power over, you're ultimately constantly moving towards death, because you have to always be in a position of defending that power or having that power taken from you in a violent way. And to me, that's the invitation of power with is like, you can be in a power that is not fatal with other people, right?
Yeah.
And I'm cultivating that landscape in grievers. I'm really, for me, it's like I need, you know, my thing for myself. I don't know if you've read Steve Biko's I Write What I Like, but it's a memoir, political memoir of a South African anti-apartheid organizer that I love. But I write what I need.
Yeah.
I write what I need. And I feel like sometimes I like what comes out. A lot of times I'm just like, well, it's true or it's honest. It's true to me.
Yeah.
And what I feel like right now is I'm like, I need to write something.
What? My radio stuck on CKUT. I don't know. But nah, fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the world.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Brian Jefferson. You were just listening to It's Going Down Radio. This was their November 28th episode. You can find all their content, like this episode, at itsgoingdownradio.libsyn.org. And before we leave you, here's some local news that you can use. The community group Solidarity Across Borders is holding a rally tomorrow at McGill Metro. They're responding to the province's ongoing calls for action and solutions to what provincial officials call a labor shortage. SAB promotes status for everyone, and they say labor shortages can be fixed by granting universal status for all. That's at 12 tomorrow at McGill Metro. And almost every shelter in the city is looking right now for donations of winter clothes and other household items. If you have an old quality coat or warm clothes to donate, you can drop them off at Resilience Montreal, the Open Door Shelter, the Welcome Collective, or a community organization closest to you.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or news intern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Hour, or connect with us on Facebook. Search for us on CKUT.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Loro yung ibig sabihin ng pinasukyo yung ibig sabihin ng pinasukyo.